brought to you by the Fetzer Institute, helping to build a spiritual foundation for a loving world. Welcome, everybody, to the Wonder in Awe podcast. It's my honor to have Sarah Luria, who's a rabbi, a founder, and a cultivator of ideas and dreams, and currently leading Beloved, a network of spiritual leaders planting new projects and communities. After her 4 years as a spiritual leader of Beloved Brooklyn. Prior to Beloved, Sarah was the founder and the executive director of Immersive New York City, a community mikveh, now part of the JCC Manhattan. Sarah recently moved from Brooklyn, New York, to Northampton, Massachusetts, with her husband, 3 kids, and her pandemic puppy. Welcome, Sarah.
Thank you so much for having me.
Sarah, when did you realize you wanted to become a spiritual leader?
So when I was a girl, I loved being at synagogue, and I was the only one. Like, I was the only kid that was excited to go to synagogue. Most kids, as you might know, were not super excited to go to synagogue or church or wherever their parents were dragging them on Saturday or Sunday. And I loved it. And everyone told me I should be a rabbi. And I thought, no way, rabbis have to know everything. Like, it just seemed to me that my rabbi had all the facts in her head. And I just didn't think I could do that. And then when I was at college, I was a sophomore, and the president of my Hillel, which is the Jewish student group, in 2001. And, you know, first week of school, the Twin Towers fall. And I spent that year as a spiritual leader in a way that I was definitely not expecting as a 19-year-old. And I really learned a lot that year. And I thought, at the end of that year, I thought, if being a spiritual leader is about having all the facts in my head and knowing the history and being brilliant, I don't think I can do that. But if being a spiritual leader is about loving people through really hard times and transitions and understanding themselves better and praying together and singing together and trying to form community under very hard circumstances, then that's what I want to do. So that was a long time ago, I guess, at this point. And here we are.
Well, but we're also going through these times of transition. I think in religion in general, people are looking for different alternatives to going to synagogue and church. How are you seeing it and helping to navigate that transition?
Yeah, I have to say, even though I started my journey and I shared with you about going to synagogue as a girl, I never really was drawn to becoming a congregational leader. My interest is really in witnessing people in times of transition. I think that's like my deepest call as a spiritual leader. And when I was, I tell the story that when I was a girl, my parents got divorced, and I felt like there needed to be more ritual, more religious, spiritual ritual in my life when I was undergoing this big transition. And when I was ordained as a rabbi, that was the first work I really wanted to do, was to stand with people undergoing transition and say, there's a Jewish ritual for you in a time that you might not think there's one, because people always think of the birth, bar mitzvah, which is coming of age ceremony, wedding and funeral as the time when religion can really like step in and support you. And I think, what about in our lives? Like, what about in the rest of our lives? You know, what if you don't get married and you don't have a baby? Then, you know, forget it. You know, no one's interested in you. So I just think we need ritual for times of all kinds of transitions in our lives. And so I really started my rabbinate thinking about, okay, what are the Jewish rituals, ancient Jewish rituals that we have in our back pocket that we can use to support people who would otherwise not go to synagogue and not even think Judaism had much to say about their lives. And so it was a funny entrance into the rabbinate to start as a progressive Jew, to start a ritual organization that focused on mikveh, which your Jewish listeners and audience will know, is not something that most progressive Jews think about, but it's a ritual about immersing in a body of water and enacting a physical and spiritual and emotional cleansing and transition. And so I learned from that experience of guiding many people through that ritual and supporting leaders and witnesses and guides and volunteers to support other people through that. Wow, there's a whole world of people out there who are hungry for deep ritual, ancient wisdom, hope, possibility, and sacred witness. And how are we offering that to them beyond the walls of any building? And so that really catalyzed me.
Well, you know, there's a whole wellness movement happening right now. And it's kind of interesting because, like, you could go to a spa, you know, a resort, about, you know, $2,000 a day, and like, you know, go into the hot tub and the steam room, you know, do all of that stuff, which sounds like the mikvah. Eat organic food, which means also being present and thankful and grateful for the food that's on your plate, which is what the brachas were about, which is what the blessings were about, right? And I've recently gotten into this myself, just observing the Sabbath, but in a completely different way, where people are saying, you know, cyber Sabbath, where you don't connect to your phone, you know, you're not on, you go off the grid, you're not doing your work. And again, that these it sounds like from ancient wisdom, we had all these beautiful practices. Somehow it got a little bit, or, you know, calcified into these rigid things, which made me, and I think make other people reject it, thinking, you know, what I want to do is, I think I'll go to Miraval. I'll go to Canyon Ranch. I'm just going to, you know, do the spa treatments, get a massage, not think about anything, eat healthy food. And guess what? That was maybe the core essence of Judaism, you know, in the past. And it somehow swung, perhaps, and we talked about this a little bit, maybe to copy the Christian practices after World War II. Why did that happen?
So many, many things to say about what you just said. First of all, I think that my most quoted text that I use in my day-to-day work is by Martin Buber, who's a 20th century Jewish philosopher. And he writes a book called On Judaism. And he talks about the difference between religion and religiosity. And what he says is we need both. So religion would be the texts and traditions and rituals that have been handed down for centuries, or from your grandparents to your parents to you, or however you got your traditions, that's the religion, and that it hardens over time. And it's really an encapsulation of what, let's say, your grandparents were dreaming about and hoping for, and what their world contained. And then you, as the new generation, you, for religion to matter and for religion to be relevant, you have to infuse religiosity. And religiosity is a sense of awe and wonder in nature, in the world, in relationships. It has to be yours, right? And so you take this newfound religiosity that every generation experiences, and you look at religion and you think, ugh, that's some calcified old thing that my grandparents used to do. It's meaningless to me, right? And then, or it doesn't have a lot of meaning for me. And then you imbue your religiosity into the religion. And religion can only be passed down if it goes through these cycles, right? Like, we're not doing the same thing we were doing 300 years ago, because this cycle has happened over and over again. And so I think what you received is religion. And what you are definitely doing with your work and in your life and in your relationships is reorienting into religiosity and reinfusing the religiosity into, let's say, religion, even though you might differ with that. You might not agree with that word. And then it will look different than it did for your grandparents. It's supposed to. And the ancient wisdom, the spiritual technology that can hold up over thousands of generations and keep doing this dance of forward, you know, forward motion, that means that it's worth keeping around, right? But it's worth keeping around in whatever, in the ways that it is relevant to us. And so that's another piece of what I would say to what you're, to your question, to your frustration, is just that, yeah, spiritual technology, I think is very similar, at least in the Abrahamic traditions, right? We have water that we all use for the sacred. We have bread that we use for the sacred. We have oil. Some use oil. Some use wine, right? We think about the cycle of our calendar, the cycle of our days. It's not that it's so different. It's not that it's rocket science, the differences. But the important thing is that we take the spiritual technology and we use it to matter to us in our time. And so if a wellness retreat is your spiritual technology, wonderful. There is imbued in that ancient bathhouses in Greece, right? And that's the similar to, has resonances with the mikvah in Jerusalem when the temple stood, right? One thing I do want to say to me is a really important difference. One is community. The wellness world that you were speaking about often is about the individual. And I do think that for these, quote, spiritual technologies to work, to quote, work, you need community. You need to be with people in it, right? Because you can be as healthy as you can be, right? And you have infinite choices about where you want to go on a spa vacation and what kind of kale you want to eat and all those beautiful things that create a healthy life. And yet there's something about being in a community of people that are sharing the spiritual technology that transforms the experience from just like what I want as Sarah to what can help elevate us as humanity, as a species, as a people doing this practice. And that is a really different mode. And that is what creates belonging, which I think is another buzzword of our time, like wellness. Belonging is kind of the other side, another part of that. And belonging can only happen, I think, in community.
Well, and that's what, you know, I've learned just by observing nature as well. You know, the mycelial network under the ground, yes. You know, connects trees and plants to each other, how a mother tree takes care of its child, its offspring. I mean, it does happen in nature, even in the plant world, which most people, you know, aren't really aware of. And that communities survive better than individuals. Nothing lives alone in nature. So that does seem to be nature's operating instructions. And obviously we should be learning from that and trying to mirror that, which, you know, makes a lot of sense. So with your organization, Beloved, are you trying to help the people that are like, let's say, looking for reinventing or reimagining these, you know, historic or ancient, you know, Jewish religious practices and giving them some type of guidance or maybe validation or help? Because I do know one thing about liberals and Jews. We all like to be very different and have our own points of view. You know, really, uh-huh. If you look at the right, everybody like marches in lockstep. It's one of the problems in politics between, you know, liberals and conservatives. Conservatives will all agree this is one thing we're doing. We're all going to do it the same way. Mm-hmm. Liberals, because they're open-minded, I think have a lot of ideas. You know, mm-hmm. not that one is worse than the other, but when mm-hmm. you have a lot of ideas, you have a lot of directions that you want to go. And look, in Israel, mm-hmm. look at the Knesset. How many political mm-hmm. parties do they have? You know, mm-hmm. dozens.
And there's something so beautiful about it if they could get together in a meaningful way that wasn't corrupt.
So getting back to the tell me about Beloved and why, you know, you're helping to kind of guide the experimentation that you're observing.
I want to go back to what you said about nature for a moment, because I think that's the key, right? Is that it's not that nature is a guide for us as much as we are nature, right? Like, we are all, I mean, the central tenet of Judaism, and I think a lot of spiritual practices and religions, is the interconnectedness of all. And so it's not that the mycelial network should operate one way and us humans, well, we should be individuals, right? Like, no, I think you bringing that is such a, it's so powerful to say that, how do the mycelial network interact? How do the trees talk to each other underground through their roots? How do the birds communicate when it's time to fly? And then how do we do that too, right? Like, we need it just as much as they do, right, for survival. And so we are part of that. And that we've lost that along the way since, in my view, since enlightenment, right? Because enlightenment really gave us the capacity to be individuals, and how exciting it is to be, feel like you're an individual and you have your own wants and desires and your own interests and your own path to pursue. But if you're doing it alone, then we're separating ourselves from all the wisdom around us that's teaching us not to operate alone. And that, I think, goes to the beloved, the question you asked about beloved as well, which is that I do think that our progressive spiritual leaders, who are the ones that I serve, our progressive spiritual leaders do have a lot of different visions and ways and methodologies for serving their communities right now, for supporting community right now. And so, but my job is not to say, well, you go your way and you go your way and good luck with your project, but to say, what are the infrastructures that we can imagine for creative spiritual leaders of the 21st century to live together while still doing their own projects and building their own communities, right? Because I think there's been a lot of new entrepreneurial, I'm putting in quotes, kind of ideas and projects in the last 25 years, especially in the Jewish community. And I think that's wonderful. And we need a lot of brainstorming. We need a lot of, like, and in Hebrew, the word is chomer, like a lot of material to work from. Like, and I think we have that now. And now is the time to think about what are the structures that we can work on building, so that all of this chomer, all of this new material has somewhere to live, so that we're not each person inventing community from scratch, but that we can really learn from each other and really, as spiritual leaders, feel a sense of belonging, so that we can help the people we're serving feel a sense of belonging.
It seems like, I mean, another problem is that I never, you know, growing up and, you know, experiencing perhaps more of the conservative Judaism, never really got a taste of the mystical. I'm learning about Madonnas and the Kabbalah, you know, people yeah. talk about. Why isn't, like, the Kabbalah something that is, you know, talked about, shared, or taught? I mean, nobody ever mentioned it from Sunday school to Hebrew school, yeah. ever.
Yeah.
And that would be the one thing that would have maybe turned me on.
There's a technical answer to that, which is that you're not supposed to study it until you're 40. But I've been, that's a cop out, but that is the technical.
Maybe that has to be maybe it's got to be reimagined. Maybe
reimagined.
Because maybe we're becoming quote unquote more, I mean, look at our kids. I mean, they can run circles around us with AI. Maybe it's time to take a fresh look at that idea.
I think that, the second half of the 20th century, there was a focus in the Jewish world on children and in America.
But why?
Many, many millions of Jews were wiped out in the Holocaust, in the Shoah, in Europe. And there was a real good reason in America to focus on Jewish community and Jewish children. And when I say community, I mean Jewish community centers and creating synagogues that had a pool in them so that you'd want to go on Saturday and Sunday. And, you know, there was a reason for focusing on teaching the children. I mean, Judaism is always focused on teaching the children. That's actually the most important part of a Passover Seder, is that you teach your children that you were slaves and then you are free, right? So it's not a wholly modern invention that we focus on Jewish children, but there was a trauma response to let's make sure that our children know they are Jewish. And the way we're going to do this is we are going to educate them in religious schools in the 50s through, let's say, 2010s or 2000s, right? And unfortunately, I'm sure many people know that they don't have great reputation, religious schools of the late 20th century. And I think a lot of the time, because they weren't as captivating as they could have been for children, and a lot of the time there was not a way for parents to get the education that the children were getting, right? So it was like, drop your kids off at religious school. Because of that, there's a saying in my work that is that we had pediatric Judaism, right? Like, Judaism ended at 13, essentially. You had your coming of age ceremony, you had your bar or bat mitzvah, and then you left because it was so boring. You didn't understand what you were saying. And the reason you were told to do it was because you're Jewish and this is what we do. You know, and that lasted a certain period of time. Like I said, there's a historical reason why that happened, but that's not going to fly for people in 2023 because I said so, because the authority said so. I mean, that's just like completely not going to happen, you know, because we were almost all killed in the Holocaust. Well, that was 75 years ago. That's not going to compel a young person to want to learn. And not only that, the pediatric Judaism that was boring of the late 20th century means that adults that had their bar bat mitzvah in the, you know, 70s, 80s, 90s, they don't have an exciting Jewish memory. They have a boring Jewish memory. And so, or they have a memory of Judaism being boring, I guess I should say.
Boring, but and also at times a burden, because, you know, you had to go there after school and sometimes resentment. I couldn't play Little League because Little League was on Saturday, and I was all my friends. When you're a young boy, you know, sports is a big deal, and I knew I was as good as they were, if not better, and I couldn't play Little League. That really is something that it still is a trauma that I deal with even right now when I say it. It hurts.
Absolutely. And so, of course, you wouldn't be interested in continuing Jewish study, right? Of course you wouldn't get to the point where mysticism would enter your adult Jewish life, because look at what you feel, you know, how many years later from being an 11-year-old boy who was forced to go to synagogue when he didn't want to, right? And you are not alone. This is a generational challenge. And so I think our job is to listen to our people and figure out, how do we teach you today in a way that is relevant not only to your Jewish life, perhaps, so like teaching you about the Jewish holidays, teaching you about the Jewish calendar, but also, and also, not but also, and also to your spiritual life, going chants and going on nature hikes and all kinds of ways that your spiritual life and your Jewish ritual life might have been separate. How do we reintegrate those? And I do think that that's what I know our beloved leaders are doing so beautifully. And that's why they're able to create these new spaces for people who are hungry just for what you're talking about, for saying, how come you kept Kabbalah? How come you kept mysticism from me all these years? I want it. And I want it in a Jewish context. I don't want to leave and become Buddhist. I want to stay. And I want you to show me what is in Judaism that I can sink my teeth into.
Well, you know, with my parents being Holocaust survivors, part of it was guilt too. Like, I couldn't rebel and say, I'm not going to go. I want to play Little League, you know. It's a heavy burden because we were parents to our parents. You know, it was a brand new country. They didn't know the language or the customs. They didn't understand what a PTA meeting was, report cards. You know, it was like all that stuff. I had to like introduce them into what the customs were and the culture. But again, you knew that they went through the worst thing that ever happened, you couldn't inflict any more, you know, drama or trauma in their lives. And so that was like the other part of it. That Jewish guilt thing is a big deal, you know, part of our tradition, I think.
I think we have to be gentle with ourselves about being less than a century post Shoah, right? Like when you go to Europe and you see, you know, buildings that have been around for hundreds of years, or, you know, churches that have been around for thousands of years, you know, you think, wow, there's such a deep history. They've gone through so much over there. And when we're in America, I think we're so now driven, like there's a lot of individualism and a lot of urgency and a lot of now. And I want to just soften a little bit to say, like, Judaism has gone through a grand transition in the last 100 years. And not to mention that we gained a state that we still don't know what to do with. And we've gained a level of power that Jews have never had before that we still are very uncomfortable with and don't know how to wield. And so between Judaism in Israel and Judaism in America, we are young. We are nowhere near the Christianity of 1,000 years ago, right? And so I just would say, like, everything you're sharing just reminds me, like, we've gone through a lot in the last 7,500 years, and this new phase of Judaism is scary for a lot of people because it represents a change from what we've been doing since the Shoah, essentially, since the Holocaust in America. And it's scary for people to say, well, wait a minute, we built all those synagogues for you, millennials or whatever, and now you're rejecting them. And the point isn't that we're rejecting Judaism or that we're rejecting spirit or we're rejecting our connection to all that is and all that was and all that will be, or the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and Sarah, Rebecca, Rachel, and Leah. It's just that we're rejecting the trappings somewhat because they're not going to work for us for the next 100 years, and we're trying to figure it out. And so I think about little Louie, you know, wanting to play Little League, and what you and your generation had to endure post-Holocaust. We're not over it in any way, shape, or form. We're still in it in a lot of ways. And it's going to take generations to look back and study us and try to figure out what this 100 years after the Shoah of Judaism really meant. We're in it now.
One of the things that, which might be helpful, but what I'm doing in my own life is, as an environmentalist, for example, I'm becoming more aware. And I think a lot of people are also becoming a little bit more conscious of, for example, like the food on your plate, you know, like the fact that we do a blessing, which was something you had to do. You had to say a bracha over the food. Well, now it's like, if you're conscious, if you're politically correct, before you just gobble that food, we're supposed to take a moment, you know, it's almost like saying grace and say, you know, being grateful for the earth for giving me this food, grateful for the people who grew it, who transported it, who got it here, you know. And so that kind of dovetails into the whole environmental movement, which is huge, you know. Same thing with the mycelial network, that there's this feeling of spiritual connection in the choices we make that are truly in alignment with a Jewish practice. And you think about the translation of the blessing over food, which we do all the time. But, you know, like, you know, for a fruit, Baruch Atah Adonai Eloheinu Melech Haolam, Barei Pri Haoretz, right? And then the English translation got a little skewed, like, Blessed art thou, Lord our God, King of the universe, who gives us the fruit from the tree. But I think the meaning would be more like, thank you, you know, Earth. Thank you, beautiful universe, without gender, king or queen. Thank you, universe, for the fact that you're sustaining my life with the fruit that's on my table, and for all the people that helped, you know, grow this food and bring it here, and therefore I'm not going to waste any of it, and I'm going to be conscious and grateful and thankful for the gift that I've been given.
First of all, that's beautiful. And yes, you can totally translate the blessing just like that. And I think that what I'm hearing you say is that at its best, Judaism can be about gratitude, intention, and attention. And that's what I hope for you. That's what I hope for us, you know, that we can say, you know, that instead of having the blessings be just another thing I have to do before I eat, or let's, you know, as it is at my house on Shabbat, mom, like, oh, mom, all right, we did that. All right, let's get on with it. But that they're about just like bringing us back into this moment with gratitude and setting an intention and paying attention. And I think, you know, when you said earlier, like, I just want to go to Mirabelle. Is that what you said? Mirabelle. So in the mikveh ritual, what I always say is the water is not magic, right? So the idea is that you first, when you get to the space of a mikveh, or you get to the space where the pool is, you have to prepare. You have to spend time in the changing room, in the preparation room, washing your body fully and saying blessings about washing your body fully, and getting completely naked, no earrings, no studs, no nothing, no glasses, no contacts. The idea is you want to be just like you were when you were born, as much as one can be in there, you know, as they age. And so if you get to the Miraval and you just jump in the water, like, that's great. That's called a pool, right? But when you get to the mikveh and you spend half an hour, 45 minutes in that preparation room, setting your intention, I immersed, as an example, I immersed when I weaned my third and what I believe to be my final child. I loved nursing so much, and I was so sad and also so happy to be weaning him. And once I was done nursing, I went to the mikveh and I spent time, you know, in that preparation room thinking about what it was that I was transitioning out of and into. Because as a nursing mom, you are providing this incredible magic sustenance for your child. And when you're done, you are an individual again. I felt like an individual again in a way that I didn't feel when I was nursing. And so I prepared for a while in that preparation room, and I prayed and prayed to my ancestors, to the foremothers that have gone before me. And then when I got into the pool, I felt, and I know this, I mean, you know, take it for what you will, but I felt in each corner of that small pool, Sarah, Rebecca, Rachel, and Leah standing there with me saying, I went through this too. Like, you will make it as a woman and as a mother and as a person who has nursed into this next phase, because we did too. And that was, in my opinion, because I spent all that intention time and I was grateful. And then I was paying attention to that moment. And it's those three factors that made the ritual happen. It wasn't just the water. So I think what you're saying about blessing our food, it's all of those rituals, all of those blessings can either be rote or they can be magic, full of magic and spirit. And it's how we set the intention to go into that space.
And I think there is some interesting experimentation. Intention is really important, but I have heard that there are some rabbis that are, you know, using psychedelics. And if you do a psychedelic, what's really critical is you have to have the intention, you know, of what are you expecting to have from that experience. In addition, you also have to integrate the whatever aha moment you had or insight. You can't just, you know, have an aha moment and go, you know, what am I going to do about it? How am I going to help my family, my community, my workers, you know, the world? You know, how do you practice tikkun olam? You know, how do you heal the world? So, I mean, that's just one way of doing it. It could be from going into a deep, you know, experience with music. It could be surfing a big wave, whatever it is that puts you into the ultimate present moment when you feel the flow of energy and spirituality, whatever it might be. But I love the fact that they're open to it. And, you know, this is interesting, Sarah. I forgot the name of the author, but there's this Hebrew author who wrote a book and said that it's a hypothesis that when the Jews were traveling, you know, in the desert for 40 years before they came to the promised land and they were eating manna from heaven, you know, well, there's apparently a psychedelic mushroom in the deserts of Jordan, which might explain why, you know, whatever they ate, they thought was the most delicious food they'd ever had, you know? And the theories go along with, you know, the whole thing about the burning bush and Moses, that, you know, that was a vision that he had or a hallucination or a spiritual connection. You know, it could have been, look, sacred plants and sacred ceremonies have, you know, in, perhaps were the things that triggered religion. You know, that triggered spirituality. Judaism didn't just evolve by itself. Having a out-of-body experience, having a sense of consciousness outside of your own inner ego, you know, was perhaps the first glimpse of being aware of being. And that could have happened by accident or with intention with the sacred plants that surround us. And why would God or whatever you want to call it, put a molecule in a plant or a mushroom that gives you a divine experience? Is that random or is it mathematically impossible?
You have a lot. There are a lot of things I would love to unpack in this. First of all, I don't believe in a God that puts things in things. So speaking of awe and wonder, right? Like, I believe in in divinity all around us and within us. So I don't believe in a God that's up there, you know, writing us in a book of life. That's a metaphor, right? Like, I don't believe in a God that puts things in things, because my son has leukemia. For one example, right? Like, if God put the molecule of psychedelics into plants, then does God put things in us?
I don't believe that there's a God out there. I was just saying that because you're a rabbi. I would say that there was a spiritual energy or consciousness in the universe that might have created some evolution that these molecules, you know, happen. And it's pretty heavy that, and I love the fact you're sharing the fact that your son has leukemia. I mean, how do you deal with that from a spiritual point of view?
A lot of what I said before about us being in it in the 100 years post Shoah is how I feel about leukemia, since my son is still in treatment and I'm in it. And so it's like I am always thinking in the future, how will I make sense of this? But what I will say is that the immediacy, and this is so cliche, but the immediacy of this moment is how I live my life now. The immediacy of this moment. Like, I'm not, you know, people are like, oh, you know, next year we'll do it differently. You know, like when you're planning an event or something, oh, well, next year we'll do it differently. Oh, I don't think about that. I think about this moment and how he is doing right now. My husband just found out today that, you know, the percentages of his, you know, if you have 100 kids who have his illness, then this percentage of kids will be okay and this percentage of kids won't be okay. And I just think it's, I don't care, because it's about this human right in front of me and this moment. And I don't want to hear about out of 100 kids, because there's only one kid that I care about. I mean, the other piece of it is that I do feel more connected to everything that is and everything that was and everything that will be. I do feel more connected to that. I feel that that immediacy has launched me into a sense of connection downwards and upwards and all around. That has very much happened in this experience.
No, I'll just say it happened to me recently, because, you know, I've always been eating like healthy food, you know, plant-based diet since college and all of that. Genetics play apparently a big role. I found out that my artery was clogged. The Widowmaker was like 80% clogged. Yeah. And then about 3 or 4 weeks ago, I had a stent put in. Thank God I figured it out. But boy, is my feelings of gratitude tripled and my connection tripled. And it's so true. Once you kind of feel like you're at the edge of something and everything is potentially at risk of being over, and you have a window to go forward, it's like, wow, you savor every second.
I'm so glad that you are healthy. That is quite scary. I think that the last thing I would say about that I can think of, you know, in this moment about how I'm changed, is that, like, you know, it's a cliche also to say, like, well, you know, we're humans, we're not in control, I'm not God. But like, when they called me to tell me that my son had leukemia, I was just like, I have no control over this. I have absolutely no control over this. And then when you get to the hospital and they say, it's this kind of leukemia, which is the good kind. And they could have easily said, it's the bad kind. I had no control. And then they said he has a good genetic marker instead of a bad genetic marker. And I just thought, absolutely, I'm just standing here. And this is my, like, couldn't be more important human in my life. And all I can do is just stand here and witness. And I actually think that that has been, that has always been my theology, really, or my connection to other human beings, is like, you can't save anyone, but you can stand there and witness. You know, I'm a doula. I don't practice, but I supported women in labor. I supported people in labor, and I loved being a chaplain at a hospital, and I hope that at my best as a parent, I'm a witness. And it just, you know, quadrupled this sense that, like, all I can do is sit here next to you while you're struggling. And I do think that that is the job of a spiritual leader. You know, there's more. I mean, there's more to it, but the very core of it is to sit here next to someone and say, I am your connection to your community, to the divine. I mean, it doesn't have to be a spiritual leader that connects you to the divine, but maybe they can remind you of your connection to the divine. That witness is a stand-in for the centuries of witness that have unfolded and will unfold, and that you feel like you're part of something when you're going through a transition, like sickness or weaning or recovering from a surgery, that a life-saving surgery, any of that, that reminder that you're not just going to a pool at a spa, that you're actually doing something divine and sacred. You're part of something divine and sacred.
Well, when you're witnessing, you're giving someone the greatest gift, which is your presence.
Yeah.
That is like the ultimate. So
right.
What is your definition of gratitude?
When I was pregnant with my oldest child, Caleb, I was a chaplain at a hospital. And when I was working night shift, I was the only chaplain on call in the hospital, and it was like a trauma one hospital. So a lot of stuff happens at night. And I was staying, the chaplain's like headquarters was in a building off campus, off the hospital campus. So I was pregnant, I was sleeping on an air mattress, and I was like, and when we got called in, we had to walk through through the hallway, past the morgue, into the hospital. And every time I got called in, I was scared because I was being called to witness something that most people don't ever want to witness. And I would pray with my baby, with my fetus. And I would say, you know, you're okay, I'm okay. You support me, I'll support you. We can do this together. And I felt buoyed by this fetus, by this little one inside of me that I had really never met before, but that I, who I knew deeply. That sense of being buoyed and supported, just because I'm me, not because I deserve it. Not because I deserve it more than anyone else. Mm-hmm. Just because I'm me and I'm human and I'm worthy of love and care and witness and kindness and support. That moment where I just knew that I was being witnessed and loved and I was witnessing and loving. I don't know if that's my definition of gratitude, but those are moments of gratitude that I hold with me all the time when I'm doing my work now.
Beautiful. Really beautiful. Well, thank you, Sarah, for opening your heart, sharing your experiences and wisdom. I really, really appreciate it. I want to thank the Fetzer Institute for introducing us and for supporting this podcast. And I want to thank everyone who, you know, can lean in and experience a little bit of wonder and awe and joy in your life, being present and celebrating life. That's what we're here to do. So thank you, Sarah.
Thank you so much.
Brought to you by the Fetzer Institute, helping to build a spiritual foundation for a loving world.